This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
And welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we're bringing you a medley of local and regional news and stories. We start the show out with some regional news from the Ohio Valley Resource. First, from OVR reporter Liam Niemeyer, we'll hear about shifting federal law around ephemeral waterways and how that might impact waterways throughout the Ohio Valley area. Then, from OVR reporter Becca Schimmel, we'll hear about how laid-off employees of the now-bankrupt Black Jewel Coal Company are seeking answers and back pay. Then, we'll hear about Pikeville's upcoming Pride Prom event, a fundraiser for Pikeville's second-ever Pride Festival happening in the fall of 2019. We wrap this episode up with WEKU's Tom Martin interviewing Brent Hutchinson, the director of the Heineman Settlement School, about his recent selection as an Obama Foundation Fellow. This interview was recorded for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
The Environmental Protection Agency will decide whether to remove federal protections for what are called ephemeral waterways. The dispute concerns streams and wetlands that only occasionally have water. The Obama administration included those in its Waters of the U.S. rule. The Trump administration would remove them. Liam Niemeyer reports some Ohio Valley scientists say water quality and wildlife are at stake, while farmers and developers fear excessive regulation.
West Liberty University professor Zachary Loafman has dedicated his life to crustaceans, specifically freshwater crayfish. He dips his hand into a water tank at his laboratory near Wheeling, West Virginia, to pick up a teal crayfish the size of a dollar bill.
See the little guy dropping down? We caught mom and she had like 300 babies, so we just let them grow.
His team has been all over Appalachia, searching streams, wetlands, and more, documenting crayfish. They've discovered six new species, and his students even named one of them after him. But recently, he's been worried the habitats for some crayfish may soon be threatened.
I don't know a single aquatic conservationist or biologist who thinks, yeah, this rule's great.
Loafman is referring to the current Trump administration proposal the US EPA is considering that would take away federal protections from ephemeral wetlands and streams. Ephemeral means they only have water during heavy rain, and that's where some kinds of crayfish live. He and other biologists worry the rule change would cut protection for waterways and open the door for more pollution.
You know, if this were to go into law, we would be losing protection for millions of acres of wetlands, millions of miles of streams.
That's Ohio State University's School of Environment and Natural Resources professor Majeka Sullivan. He helped review a 2015 EPA report that detailed how ephemeral streams and wetlands help filter water to the larger watershed. He says future drought from climate change could mean that more Ohio Valley streams would become ephemeral.
An intermittent stream today could become an ephemeral stream in the future, and then it would fall out of protection. And we're seeing that, at least anecdotally, in areas of Ohio.
The Obama administration cited that report when they tried to expand Clean Water Act protections to include ephemeral streams and wetlands. But developers, the coal industries, and farmers pushed back, fearing excessive regulation. Central Kentucky soybean farmer Larry Thomas favors the Trump version of the rule. Among tall weeds on his farm, he points to a nearby creek bed.
This stream, and I don't know where it stops, will not run year-round.
Thomas says he was worried the Obama-era definition of protected waters was so vague that it could extend to things like water retention ponds on his farm, even though agriculture was exempted from the rule.
They want to grab another tributary and bring into that. And that's what we've done, and that's how we've got to this point. So we've got to say somewhere, where does this stop? Otherwise, we wind up in people's yards.
He believes the Trump proposal provides more clarity for farmers about what water bodies are regulated. But other area farmers say those concerns are misplaced. Laura DeYoung raises sheep in Northwest Ohio and trusts the EPA to stand by their agriculture exemption.
I just think there are better battles to fight, and this isn't a battle they need to fight.
The Obama Clean Water Act rule is currently only in force in 22 states, including Ohio, because of ongoing lawsuits. West Virginia and Kentucky are among the states that had the rule stopped in federal court. West Virginia University agriculture law professor Jesse Richardson says even more lawsuits are likely if the Trump proposal is approved.
So I think it's just going to wind its way through the courts for 5 years, 10 years, who knows?
An EPA spokesperson expects a decision by December. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
More than 100 coal miners and family members gathered Wednesday in Whitesburg, Kentucky, in an attempt to get some answers and their pay from failed mining company Black Jewel. The country's sixth largest coal company filed bankruptcy last week, and many of Black Jewel's 1,100 workers across Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia were suddenly out of work. As Brittany Patterson reports, most are still waiting for back wages as well as answers about the company's future.
Patrick Fitzpatrick has worked at Black Jewel's D11 coal mine in Cumberland, Kentucky for a year and a half. He says he enjoyed the work right up until he was told not to come in last Monday.
Everything was going fine. Everything was smooth sailing. And then just one day, it just goes all to hell.
Then he got more bad news from the bank. His paycheck bounced. Fitzpatrick says he has yet to receive more than $4,000 in owed wages. The father of two just bought a house and truck. Now he's struggling to pay his bills.
I'm having to sell my tools, my guns, everything that I've worked hard for just to try to make ends meet.
Over the last decade, many, including big players like Peabody Energy and Arch Coal, have chosen to restructure under Chapter 11 protection. But since filing on July 1st, Black Jewel's bankruptcy has been anything but routine.
Obviously, last week I don't think went the way anyone was hoping or expecting.
That's Black Jewel attorney Travis McRoberts at a bankruptcy hearing Saturday. Federal bankruptcy judge Frank Volk called the hearing to discuss problems with company paychecks.
It has visited, as we all know, a significant hardship on these employees and their families.
Last week, Volk approved a $5 million loan to Black Jewel to help keep it afloat, on the condition the company's CEO, Milton, West Virginia multimillionaire Jeff Hoops, resign. But the company needs more money, a lot more. It owes tens of millions of dollars in unpaid local, state, and federal taxes, royalties, and to vendors, amounts that some industry watchers find remarkable.
When you look through the list of debt, it's just like, holy cow, you know, how do you get this far in debt?
Clark Williams Derry is director of energy finance at the Sightline Institute, a Seattle-based think tank. He says Black Jewel's bankruptcy has been unusually chaotic.
How do you get this far behind on your payments, wind up with $100,000 in the bank, and not think you're getting close to bankruptcy?
At the Saturday hearing, Black Jewel's lawyers told the court without another infusion of cash, it can't pay its Appalachian employees. Right now, the company is only paying workers once they are called back to work. And so far, only a few dozen have gotten that call and their paychecks. At a Wednesday information session in Whitesburg, Kentucky, more than 100 Black Jewel employees and their families packed the Letcher County Recreation Center. County officials and a labor attorney, Sam Petzonk, urged employees to keep paperwork documenting hardships from the sudden layoffs.
You have rights under state and federal law to receive the wages that you earn.
Kentucky's attorney general has opened an investigation into Black Jewel. On Tuesday, an employee filed a class action lawsuit alleging the company failed to provide adequate notice of the layoffs under federal law. Bobby Balthus worked at Black Jewel's Clover Lick 3 mine in Harlan County. He says he was able to cash his last paycheck, but then it was clawed back or made void after deposit.
My check that I'd cashed out of my savings and then charged me $12 for for the company's check that bounced.
Balthus says he's put some money aside in case of a layoff, but he knows many who are hurting.
But I've been doing this for 27 years, and you can't never trust the coal industry because you don't know one day to the next.
Black Jewel's next bankruptcy hearing is scheduled for Friday. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Next up, WMMT's Sydney Bowles brings us an interview with two organizers of Pikeville's first ever Pride Prom.
How the heck are we doing, everybody?
Last year's Pikeville Pride Festival brought in hundreds of attendees, many of them touched to attend such an event in their hometown. Now, the organizers of the Pride Festival are back. This time, they're throwing prom. I spoke to organizers Gina Bryant and Autumn Parker about their visions for the event. Here's Autumn. She's in charge of decorations.
For prom, I'm looking for everyone's new or first opportunity to just kind of have a good time, be themselves in a safe space, dress however they want. Like, we're telling people they can come in, like, jean jackets or ball gowns or whatever they want.
So did you have a prom when you were in high school?
Yeah, I went with my cat. He's here now. He's constipated, so that's what that is, if you hear him.
What's your cat's name?
Morris.
Morris is constipated.
Yeah, here he is. Hot mess.
Sorry, you're constipated, Morris.
I know.
Okay, so prom is like, the reason that I asked if you had a prom and the fact that you wanted to bring your cat is tremendous. The reason that I asked is because prom is like kind of a loaded, like, coming of age American experience, right? Like, making a queer prom is kind of a big deal.
Oh, so, yeah, for sure.
Like, you could talk a little bit about like what it means to have a prom that's like designed to be a queer experience.
Yeah, so I feel like it's definitely unique. It's definitely different and it's definitely important. I feel like for perspective of people who don't really think about this on a day-to-day basis, like people who are like, why do you need a queer prom? It's like, they don't really understand that there's like such like a weird stereotype behind it where you have to like ask your straight friend like, oh, hey, go with me, please. Like, I don't want to be like coming off as something different, and then you can dance with like your actual date. It's not relaxing and it's not a fun experience.
Right. Like, I feel like I knew that I was queer in high school.
Yeah.
I didn't, like, I wasn't dating anyone and I wasn't really out, and I felt like I would like just not have had the bravery or the like the knowledge of my own self to like, we didn't have a prom at my school, but like if we had, I would have no idea how to navigate that.
Yeah, I had the blessing of this dear, sweet summer child boy. And so everyone was, like, pushing me and him to go to prom together. And so part of me was like, oh, we can go. He's really nice. But then the other part of me was like, what if he starts to like me? What if he wants to date me? What does that mean? I'm not ready. And so I was like, I'm going with my cat.
Why didn't they let you go with Morris?
Cat allergies, obviously. It's definitely an experience I'm still so ready for. Just to be in, like, an environment where it's not, like, expected. Or, like, when the slow dance song comes on and you panic because it's, like, welp.
Yeah, this way it's, like, we all just, like, dance with each other in beautiful support.
Yeah, it's a lot more, like, family feeling.
What's the age range for prom?
We are all over the board, so everyone of all ages is welcome. Anyone below 16 needs a chaperone for obvious reasons. We just need to keep people safe, which I understand totally sucks, because if you're under 16, you don't always want a chaperone. But it is important for this event to make sure everyone's staying safe and in a good space. So there will be 100% no tolerance policy on alcohol, drugs, or anything else. We're focusing highly on keeping this a safe space for the younger kids and making sure that parents feel comfortable sending their kids here. We want to make sure that this is an event that parents are confident that they can send their children here or go with their children. That'd be wonderful. We're looking at having like a lip sync RuPaul Drag Race kind of style dance off thing for whoever wants to participate. Right after prom, there is the one bar crawl. So we're going to go over to bank and crawl home.
If people want to go get tickets or learn more, where should they go?
If you just go onto the Facebook event for Pikeville Pride Prom All Ages, you will be able to access and purchase tickets. Adult admission would be $20. Youth admission is $10. And if you want to sponsor a youth scholarship with your adult ticket, you can purchase both for $30.
Next up, Gina Bryant.
Your question about like how I got involved is annoying me because I actually do not remember the point that I got involved with all of this. I feel like it's always something that I always wanted for this area, but I didn't believe would actually be a thing. So.
It must feel kind of cool to get to be a part of something that you never thought would happen.
It is. It's amazing. Growing up here, I was born here. I grew up here. I went to school here. I've always lived here. And in high school, you know, I didn't admit yet that I was bi. I had all this internalized homophobia and, you know, this fear of coming out. And I never thought that this was something that I would see here. I always thought that I would have to go to a big city to be who I really was and to find my people, you know. At Pride, we had so many young people, so many teenagers, come up to us and tell us how much this meant for them and how much they wanted to see things like this in their area and how they didn't feel, you know, comfortable. So we really wanted to make something for them.
Yeah, I mean, so last year's Pride happened, and then there was, you know, you wanted to do it again, right? It was an idea that it would be an annual thing. So where did this prom idea come from?
It was always an idea to make this an annual thing and to try and grow and to really change our area. So we were debating on whether or not we should do our Pride event in June, Pride Month, or if we should wait until October again. So we decided to do an event both months. And I think there were many of us who, when we were in high school, didn't feel safe or allowed to ask maybe the person we wanted to go with. So this is for us, and this is also for the young people who are currently in high school and maybe still don't feel safe. And I think that's a really powerful thing to offer people in this area.
I mean, prom is like a really like potent like experience, right? It's like a coming of age thing. It's a time for like young love. It's a time for like going a little wild. It's like this really sort of powerful like American
event. Tradition.
Yeah, tradition. Yeah, exactly. But to have a queer prom is a little bit radical. What's the dress code?
Oh, the dress code is actually it's casual. It's as casual or extravagant as you want to be. Honestly, come as you are, as who you want to be, as, you know, who you couldn't be, maybe.
As Gina and Autumn said, you can learn more about Pikeville Pride Prom by searching for it on Facebook. For WMMT, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Last in this episode of Mountain News, we bring you Tom Martin's recent interview with Brent Hutchinson for WEKU's Eastern Standard program.
This spring, Brent Hutchinson, executive director of the Heinemann Settlement School, learned that he had been chosen for an Obama Foundation fellowship, joining 19 other community-minded rising stars from all around the world for a two-year program that's designed to inspire a wave of civic innovation. So Dr. Hutchinson, a native of Eastern Kentucky and a Morehead State University graduate, is now trading insights and ideas with leaders representing 10 countries and 5 continents, all searching for solutions to many of the world's most pressing problems, problems like those that we see faced by the people of Appalachian Kentucky. He joins us from a studio at WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks for joining us, Brent, and congratulations on your selection as an Obama Fellow.
Thanks so much, Tom.
So the first Fellows gathering, as I understand it, was in D.C. in May. Tell us about that and maybe some takeaways.
Sure. The Fellows gathered in Washington, D.C. For 5 days, and we actually gathered alongside the first cohort, which was named last year. And it was 5 days of getting to know the Obama Foundation, what our responsibilities, honestly, would be as Fellows, but also the opportunities that were being laid out before us. And so we spent the majority of that time getting to know one another, trying to unpack a little bit about why we are in that room as opposed to the 5,000 other people that it could have been, and really trying to figure out from there where we go from here, what we all kind of collectively are able to harness toward this wave, as they call a wave of civic innovation.
So a release about your selection says Obama Foundation Fellows, quote, tackle big, complex issues in unique and inspiring ways. What sorts of issues are you taking to the table?
Well, I can tell you from a couple of different perspectives, what they say about the work we're doing at Hyman Settlement School is that we are approaching the issues we face in Eastern Kentucky from a holistic perspective and a community-based perspective in an effort to help people thrive where they live. And that's something, that, honestly, that I've talked about since I began my tenure at Hyman Settlement School 7 years ago. We live in rapidly changing times with multiple challenges that are incredibly complex, that are not just things that have been created and dropped on us recently, but things that we've been facing really for decades, for generations, honestly. And how do we figure out how people who live here now can thrive where they live as opposed to having to go elsewhere in order to find means to an end, you know, an income that supports their lifestyle or appropriate education or healthcare or whatever it might be? How can we augment life here in such a way that if people want to be here, they don't have to look elsewhere? You know, smart people stay here and work here. We have creative ideas that are our own and that don't come from the outside. Those are the types of things that we've been thinking about for a while. And so the fellowship in many ways is a recognition of that effort.
And so that goes to what has been identified as a really serious problem for the region, and that is depopulation.
Yeah, significant population. We have an out-migration that's not slowing down.
A huge advantage that cities have over rural communities is enormous local consumer bases. For rural communities in places like Eastern Kentucky, the local consumer base is a lot thinner, and so there's only so much demand that can be pulled out of it. So how, in light of that, can rural communities survive, much less thrive?
That's a great question. Rural communities have survived for generations with very little. And so when we think about how we are using the resources that we have to move ourselves forward, you know, we have to be able to look at ourselves internally first to realize what we do have, with that we don't take our resources elsewhere, that we support things like local business and local efforts. But honestly, too, we have to be able to come together and say, you know, we want to define who we are. And so when we go outside, obviously we learn new things that are important to bring back home, but we can't do that to the degree that we allow other people to define what our legacy is going to look like and be. And so I think in many ways we've done that. You know, cities have much to offer. Rural places do too, and leaders in rural places certainly can't deny the ingenuity and the passion and the power that people in our locales actually possess.
We know that employment in the coal industry is now down to 0.6% of Kentucky's overall jobs picture. What other industries might return some prosperity to the region? Is there clarity about that, or do we just really not know?
That's a good question, too. I think that we're beginning to know. You know, what we know is that when coal jobs leave communities, about 7 other jobs also leave communities. So it's not just about coal. We know that there's a residual kind of a ripple effect because of it. When I moved to Knott County in 2012, that was the same year that the last underground mine had closed there. And so I've seen what that's looked like in my time there and know that it's not just about coal jobs that are leaving. It's about people who are seeking opportunities elsewhere to try to figure out how they not only sustain their families, but give their kids opportunities to grow and thrive. And in order for that to change where we are, I think we, number one, have to look at the assets we have. And so in a place like Eastern Kentucky, that's as beautiful and hospitable as anywhere in the world, and I've had the opportunity to travel quite a bit, you know, we have the opportunity to draw people here from a tourism perspective, which I think matters. But we also have a lot going on outside of that. We know that local food and the local food movement is something that a lot of people around the country think is kind of cool, and they love going to the restaurants that are farm to table. We've done farm to table our whole existence, and it's something that has sustained us in very rich ways. I think it was now almost 2 years ago that Ronnie Lundy won the James Beard Award for her cookbook Vittles, which began to outline just the truth of Appalachian food and cooking and what that means for us. And that was a whole lot more than just a cookbook. And so we believe that at Heinemann in particular, that local food and that movement is critical to helping people thrive where they live and not be taken advantage from the outside of high food prices and low food quality. We know that if we can maintain that where we are, that's big. You know, the broadband initiative that Congressman Rogers has really led the way on for us is one that could be a potential game changer in terms of opening up a global marketplace. And so we're following that closely. If people are able to stay here and be entrepreneurial and creative and start a business that can thrive from their home in Eastern Kentucky, that's a big deal for everybody in their community. And then on top of that, we've got an aging population that continues to have needs that can be met through innovative approaches to things like healthcare. And so there's really not one answer, in my opinion, for what a new economy in this new Appalachia looks like. It's a multifaceted answer that requires us working together and being creative together and thinking outside the box. There are probably things we can learn from the outside, but the answers are going to have to come from within, and they're going to be specifically, I think, derived from the people who are here who get it the most.
Any other big reforms that you see out there that need to take place before these things can be realized?
I'm not sure if I would say that I have a sense of what big reforms there could be, but I think one of the things that's true is that people who have a vested interest in the region have to stay in the region and work for its good for long periods of time. You know, social change does not take place quickly. It takes place over time. And so people who are working hard now with big ideas and fresh ideas and really good ideas, I think need to stick with them. And I think they need to see them through. And I think more than anything have to learn how to work together in a way that maybe they never have. You know, we tend to be fairly divided as a society right now, let alone in our local communities. From one county to the next, you've got a 20-minute drive, but a completely different identity and a strong sense of what that place means and how it's different from what my place means. And there's something about that that's important and special, but at the same time, in order for us to move forward, we have to think a little bit larger than what it might mean for Knott County or Letcher County or where I grew up in Lawrence County. We might have to think regionally, and we might have to think across communities, and that's not something that we've done incredibly well for a long period of time. I think that movement in that direction, the ability to lock arms with one another with common goals and trying to move past the divisiveness of things like politics or economy, you know, the economic divide that we face, those are things that we're going to have to embrace in order for us to be able to move forward.
Well, we're going through a period of transition, of transformation, of experimentation, of uncertainty. And all of those things imply change, which is difficult for people to wrap their arms around. But it may be necessary right now. Do you think that we're just going to have to be comfortable with throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks?
Maybe to some degree. One of my college professors said the only thing that you can ever predict is that things are going to change. And so for us to be reticent to change is really a losing cause. I mean, we have to understand that things do change and that we have an opportunity to really create that change for ourselves. I think if we fear change, what we're really fearing is the ability to control, and that often comes, at least in Eastern Kentucky, from the outside. We can't control what comes from the outside toward us. But if we are able to step into these gaps ourselves and be able to articulate what we want to allow in and what ideas we want to allow out and how we can begin to really communicate in a way that puts us on the same page, you know, we begin to control that change, not in a way that's heavy-handed, but in a way that is informed. I think that's really the right approach. And so, yeah, are there going to be experiments? For sure. There have to be. But at the same time, we know what we do well, I think, as a people. And I think we see our region for what it is. We have a pretty honest sense of who we are and what we are. And so if we're able to kind of dig in together and if people are able to articulate a way forward, I think other people will follow.
Brent Hutchinson is executive director of the Hyman Settlement School and an Obama Foundation fellow, and he joins us from WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks so much, Brent.
Thanks, Tom.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org. Or download Mountain News as a podcast from SoundCloud or Stitcher. Music on this episode features Charlie Stamper with a tune called Midnight on the Water from his album Glory to the Meeting House. That album was released on Appleshop's own June Apple Recordings in 2014. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.